Hello everyone and welcome back to the Brexit Podcast. I'm your host Jennifer Han and today I'm here with a very special guest. Mairead McGuinness is not just an Irish politician and a member of the European People's Party, but she's also the Vice President of the European Parliament. She's here today to talk to us about everything from women's representation in politics to the role of the European Parliament in Brexit. Thank you for joining us, Mairead.
Delighted to be with you, and I hope we can cover all of that ground.
Fingers crossed. So obviously we have to start with the Irish border issue today. Last night, The Guardian reported that the European Commission is set to publish a position paper saying that on the UK to present a solution to the Irish border issue. So clearly this is a very special case. Do you think there is an acceptable solution that can be found, and what would that best case scenario look like for you?
Well, as I speak to you, I'm also glancing at this document which the Commission have published, and it's about guiding principles on dialogue around Ireland and Northern Ireland. And the reason why there is a separate and special paper on this, looking at the guiding principles, is because, as you have said, there are particular issues for the island of Ireland, for relationships between Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland, between Ireland and the United Kingdom, which arise because of Brexit. Many of these issues were settled up until the outcome of the UK vote, but because now the United Kingdom is leaving the European Union, we are reopening questions, and we are very concerned, for example, to make sure that the delicate peace process, which we all welcome and are here to nurture, is not damaged in any way by Brexit, and that the relationships which in the past were difficult and today are better are also protected and, if you like, defended against any negative consequences of Brexit. But one of the difficulties for all of us is that every day new issues arise or become more complicated. For example, what about children's rights in relation to Brexit? In particular, the rights of children who today in Northern Ireland can receive health care in some of our hospitals in Dublin, which very specifically deal with heart issues. What about the recognition of the qualifications of those doctors and specialists from the Republic who might travel to Northern Ireland post-Brexit? So when we say that there are particular issues which have to be dealt with around Ireland and Northern Ireland, around the peace process clearly and the Good Friday Agreement, but there's also day-to-day issues for people on the ground that will be very much impacted by whatever type of Brexit we have. And this document, which is not very long, but it has detail in it, is in a way setting out very clearly what the Commission think. And what the Commission thinks is what I have been saying over time and since the referendum, is that, you know, the European Union membership was one of the umbrella pieces, if you like, of the Good Friday Agreement. And really the United Kingdom now has to demonstrate and show how they can be fully committed and undertake all of their obligations to the Good Friday Agreement when they leave the European Union. And these questions are not settled at all. And I suppose there is an onus, and there's no suppose about it, let me be even firmer, there is an onus on the United Kingdom to come forward with very clear and workable solutions, because it was not the European Union that asked the United Kingdom to leave, but rather a decision was taken by United Kingdom to leave the European Union. And I think there are obligations arising from that decision, particularly around the peace process and the Good Friday Agreement. So at this stage, we all have concerns, but we also hope that the political process and the negotiations will lead to some good outcomes. But I think today we would be more concerned than hopeful.
So do you think that there's been sort of no scenario in which everyone gets away sort of unscathed, quote unquote? So do you think that invariably, no matter how this sort of pans out in the next couple of months and years, that there will be, for the lack of a better word, collateral damage, people who don't sort of retain their rights and their abilities to get access to healthcare and things like that as they are now? Do you think invariably some of that will be lost?
Well, I think your language is probably good insofar as there is already collateral damage from the decision of the United Kingdom to leave the European Union. For example, the currency fluctuations impact on exporters from my country to the United Kingdom. There's concerns around worker mobility. So collateral damage is already part and parcel of the story of Brexit. I think at a deeper level, when you ask the question about, you know, Brexit will impact and it's going to have damage, I think when we're talking around the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process, I think it's incumbent upon us to realise that it is not possible for us to allow for collateral damage to the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process. It is just not something that we can contemplate. So, in a sense, there is a need to protect what we have in place today, which arose from our shared membership of the European Union and also the European Union's support, both in terms of political capital and finance, for the peace process. So I'm reluctant to say and accept that there will be collateral damage around that particular issue. And on some of the other points around health, I think it would be careless and reckless to think that we would have lower health outcomes and less rights to our citizens, whether they're UK or Irish, in Northern Ireland and the Republic of Ireland because of Brexit. It makes good sense, for example, for us to cooperate on the border regions, Derry with Donegal, on health-related issues. And I don't see why Brexit should harm that. But on the other hand, as we know, there are reasons why it might. And therefore, again, we need that both sides understand the possible downsides. And I know that people on the ground, for example, who live near the border region, whether in my constituency or across the border, I mean, they are really concerned about this because they remember the past and nobody has a desire to go back to violence, and I don't contemplate that. But they do remember that sense of a division and a border. And to some extent, that's missing now. When I travel to my constituents up in Donegal, I cross the border several times. And I don't feel that I'm moving madly into a different country because it's the same parcel of land. But I do know and recognise that it is part of the United Kingdom. But it doesn't feel like a different place. And what we're trying to say is that post-Brexit, we have to try and ensure that the freedoms and the sense we have today, the feeling, if you like, on the ground, should not be damaged by Brexit. But, I mean, as I said, your use of the word collateral damage is probably appropriate. We have to limit and try and avoid. But the responsibility ultimately for Brexit is with the UK. And therefore, I think they are duty-bound. And I think they perhaps understand that, the UK side. At least I hope that that is the case, to come forward with solutions which don't damage relationships, don't damage communications, all of the structures that are there, and that pay full and due respects to the Good Friday Agreement and the peace process in all its parts.
I know there's still a lot to say on this topic, but I realise that we are short on time and I wouldn't want to let you go without talking a bit about yourself first. So I think your story is really interesting because you sort of went from studying agricultural economics to working in journalism to working in politics. So how did that come about for you? Why were you interested in politics?
Well, I suppose I was always interested in politics, but it took me quite a while to actually become a politician. But I've come from a large family, so there were usually 11 of us around a table and we would discuss issues. And I think when I was a teenager, Ireland was a much more closed place and there were issues coming to the surface and the debates were beginning to be strong and more public. And I think as teenagers we were very engaged in those debates, and I would have debated at school level and college level. And yes, I did study agricultural economics, but I always had a desire to become involved in journalism. I did want to work in television, but I never had connections. I didn't know anybody who was involved, so I wasn't sure how this would work out. But as I often say to groups of students that I meet, sometimes if you harbour a little desire, and even if you're not sure how to get there, things can come to pass. So I was lucky to some extent as well, and I think sometimes luck is very important. But when I qualified, I managed to get a work with our national broadcaster as a trainee radio producer. And from then on, I, you know, fought and battled for contracts and got kept on. And it snowballed and evolved from there. It was always challenging, as journalism is today. It was challenging then to get, you know, work. And I would have worked in broadcast, television, radio, but also in the print media as well. And then in the back of my mind, I would have kept that interest in politics. A lot of my journalistic work would have been talking with politicians, looking at policy, whether it was around agriculture or food or the environment. So I think in a way the two professions are quite linked, although they're separate. And when there was an opportunity to run for the position in the European Parliament, I stood in 2004 for Fine Gael and I was elected. And in as much as I look back and think, well, how did that happen? Because I'm reflecting on that now. I know that at the time it was a difficult challenge because, as anyone who stood for any election will know, it can be challenging to put your name and your face out there. Unfortunately, I think politics is not a profession that has a good reputation, which is also a difficulty, I think, for those of us who take the job seriously and give it our best. But having said that, and being in the Parliament now for a number of years and as Vice President, I think the capacity to input into policy and to raise Irish issues at particularly this sensitive time around Brexit and to have a voice at the table is hugely important for me and for my country. So I think it's a huge honour. And I would always say to people who might be listening that if you have any sneaking desire or interest, you know, find a way to unleash that potential because it is something worth doing. It is tough. It's challenging. It's demanding. And as I say, it doesn't often get respect, which is something I think politics and politicians need to look at. But I suppose the career path is, it looks strange when you say agricultural economics and now in politics, but I think there is a thread of almost continuity in it. It was dealing with public issues, with people, let them tell their stories. And in a way, I still do that and try and make sure that the work I do makes people's lives better or easier in a world that's hugely uncertain.
You just mentioned that you'd like to encourage people to get involved in politics, but I feel like there's this, especially for young people, and I'm including myself in this because clearly I am interested in politics. I run this podcast, but I find like there's a very high barrier of entry to politics. Somehow I don't know how quite to go about it. So what would your advice be for people like me?
Oh, gosh. I suppose there's at two levels I'm going to give advice, whether this is of help or not. You can tell me afterwards. I think the first level, whatever your dreams are, I mean, lots of people want to be brain surgeons, but clearly they're not equipped. So some things you just cannot do. But other things, if you have a real passion for and are driven, you can achieve it regardless of the barriers. But I think you are right to say that the barriers of entry to politics are high because very few of us become politicians. It is a restricted number of people in all countries that get involved in politics. But there are different levels. And I think if somebody's interested, I mean, my entry was slightly different, but other people start maybe in college, in political organisations, in community groups, in sporting organisations. They start working with people and through that become involved on committees, get experience, stand for election. Again, it could be through sport or through leisure committees or whatever. But all of that builds to the idea of representing others. So I think it's a question of if you're very passionate about it and if you're passionate about particular ideas, it's finding a path to get those onto the agenda. And I really believe that if you're passionate enough, it will happen. But you can't say that will happen without effort. And maybe the problem today is that politics is, because it's tough to get into, and even if you think of women in politics, we're still fewer than perhaps would be desirable. There are reasons why that is, and we might want to discuss it. But I think a lot of people look at it and say, no way, I would not want to get involved in politics. On the other hand, there are many who look at it and say, gosh, I'd like to get involved. And the only way to do it is to just get stuck in, join, go to the meetings, be present, be active, be prepared to fail because at some point you will win. And I think that perhaps is the most difficult part of the political story, that you don't win every time you stand for election, whether it's for national, local or European politics or even within structures of political parties. But if you don't make the effort to stand, then nobody will take you seriously or will say, gosh, this person is really interested. Maybe the next time around I'll support them because they're quite passionate about what they do. So I think there's really a need for people who are very keen to just get stuck in and roll with it because it's not easy. But on the other hand, I think, and it's fair to say my own experience would say that at least when you're involved and you're in the room, you can make things happen. And even though it was tough in my first campaign, and indeed all campaigns are tough, I always reflect after an election, never during it because it's tough, but after election and when you get through, you think, God, it is worth doing, because now I can get on with a job that I think is actually, you know, something that I want to be involved in. And I'm involved in the Agriculture Committee here, the Environment Committee, the Constitutional Affairs Committee. I'm looking at Brexit in all of those areas and many, many other things. And I think the responsibility is huge. The honour of being involved in that is huge. And when things go well afterwards, the rewards are also great. But sometimes they don't go well. You don't always get to achieve your dreams politically, but at least I'm there to try.
The numbers are actually really poignant when it comes to the proportion of women in politics. So according to the UN, only 25.3% of different members of parliament in Europe are women. And internationally, only 10 women are heads of state and 9 are head of government. What do you think is some concrete action that we can take to encourage women to go into politics? Is it doing something like Justin Trudeau, the Canadian Prime Minister, for example, who has his cabinet divided exactly 50-50 men and women? So is it a quota system? How do you see us tackling this issue in the future?
Well, I often say that when I was 17, I believed that we would achieve more equal visibility and representation of women through our own hard work. And I regret to say that many, many years later, and at a much wiser age maybe, I now realise that we will not achieve it by, if you like, no action. So in other words, I do and have come around to believing that quotas are necessary. We have them in Ireland for political parties have to put forward a percentage of women, as in this case, but it's you know, a balanced, if you like, number of candidates, men and women. And if you start at local level, then that will build into national level. I think there are other issues as well about how politics works, which makes it maybe unattractive to women, or sometimes women don't see themselves in the role. And the reason we don't see ourselves often in the role is that we don't see women in the pictures. So if you look at, and you've just said about the heads of state, if you look at any big gathering globally, it's men in suits. And there is one or two women who stand out because they're few. And until, I mean, it's a vicious circle here, because until we see more women, I think women will be reluctant to get involved. And I think we have to question the lifestyle, because, okay, the European Parliament, we have to be away, of course, from home and family. That's part of the job. I think even in national parliaments, you know, people have to work, you know, irregular hours, or they're away from families. I think some men and women make decisions that they don't want to be part of that. So I think there is a lot of work and thought needs to go into doing it. But until we actually make the commitment to say that we do want to change the situation, and many countries are making that commitment that they want to see a more balanced ticket, if you like, more balance of men and women in political life. But we also need to see it in sporting life, in communities. I mean, women are very active in community organisations, but they may not have a title, but they might be very active in different roles. So I think that, you know, 17-year-olds today need to look at what's happening and maybe be a bit more aggressive about their ideas as to how to change things. My worry is that do women who are 17 today actually see this as an issue? I sometimes think they don't. I think those of us who've gone through the mill, if you like, do see it as an issue. And I would be a bit concerned that younger women think that, you know, these equality issues are not that they're not important, but they're not big issues. But they are. And clearly we need a younger generation to take on this issue and, you know, be passionate about it and speak up and make sure that this is not something that is just a token nod towards, yes, let's get more women involved in politics because it makes men look good if they're standing beside a woman. I mean, sometimes I cringe with that type of approach, and I dare say that happens. But let's get women and men involved in politics because we need to have balance of views, of gender, of approach, of age, of all sorts of things.
If we're talking about the UK specifically, Theresa May actually got a lot of criticism, especially for her first cabinet, that it was basically consistent of old white men. I think there was even a BuzzFeed article asking people whether they could distinguish all of the old white men in the photo of her cabinet, which is rather extreme. So how do you feel that this issue is sort of the state of this issue in the UK in particular with Theresa May's government?
I was aware of those comments. I suppose I won't, you know, specifically name or whatever, but I think people, the fact that they're commenting, are more aware of this. I also think we have to be a little bit careful about saying that old or grey or white is a problem now, because that isn't the issue. The issue is to say, if you look at selecting people to work as she was within a cabinet, can I draw from a more varied experience of gender and other issues to make sure that I have a good team around me? Now, she made her decision based on, I presume, what she felt was best from her side, but it did raise the question. And I suppose the fact that people are, you know, looking at these things in a more forensic way is a good thing, that they're not just accepting the norm. But I would be a bit concerned that we go for then picking people in slots that just fit a, you know, young, female, white, whatever. I think that's a danger that I don't want to go into. What I'd like to see is that men and women of ability, you know, get, if you like, into positions where they can influence political policy in a direction which is important for society. So, people do see these things more visibly now. Whether the political establishment will react, that's something to watch for. But if we don't keep the debate going, there will be no change at all.
Now, as I mentioned earlier, you are the Vice President of the European Parliament. I think within the UK, there was always a bit of confusion about what a lot of European bodies actually do. So I'm wondering whether you could, this might be an impossible task, but give me sort of a brief overview of what the European Parliament does and what you do within it.
Okay, well, the European Parliament is a parliament. I mean, I think people understand that. It is made up of members from the 28 countries that are part of the European Union. I'm from, as you know, Ireland, so we have 11 Irish members of the European Parliament. We're a small country, so relatively speaking, we are few in number. But the one great thing about the European Parliament is that regardless of the size of country you come from, if you are a strong contributor, I think if you're committed to the work, your voice will be heard and it will be listened to. So I regard the European Parliament as a place where the voice of people is heard, is reflected. It's also a place where we pass legislation. I think that's a hugely important part of the work we do. So in the Environment Committee this morning, we voted on issues around energy efficiency, around food, all of these kind of very important practical issues for people. And we do our votes in committee, and then we go to the big parliament and we vote through pieces of legislation. I think if people would regard the European Parliament as just another part of politics in their own country, like their own national parliament, and that we should work more, if you like, hand in hand. And one of my jobs as vice president is responsibility for national parliaments, and I'm really pushing that national parliaments and the European Parliament should try and work together better, so that people see us as doing the same job. Okay, we do it in different places, but we're actually covering a lot of the same policy areas, whether it's in, as I've just listed, some of them energy, you know, some around food, from agriculture, trade, etc. And that I think if we were working together better, then there might be better knowledge of what we all do. Because I think sometimes even in member states, citizens aren't quite so sure how Parliament works or aren't always happy with how Parliament works. So in a way, what we are is that we're a big Parliament. There's over 700 members. But it's essentially each of us bring the views and concerns of our constituents to the Parliament. I get the, I suppose it's one of the nicer parts of my job is I chair debates. So I get to hear all of the different views and I get to chair the votes to see in the end where the consensus lies. But it is an important house where people can come also with their problems, their concerns. And I believe that all politics is local. So in the European Parliament, we, and certainly I am, very much rooted in where I'm from and I deal with the smallest to the biggest problems, because for the individuals concerned, a problem is a problem.
So that's quite handy, actually, that everyone sort of comes to you with their concerns and you hear everyone's point of view, because I was wondering how Brexit has been received by everyone and how the ongoing negotiation process has been viewed in the Parliament.
Well, the Parliament has a very strong role in Brexit, because at the end we will have to say yes or no to whatever withdrawal agreement is eventually worked through. But, for example, this week we had in the Constitutional Affairs Committee that I sit on, we had a report back from the Parliament's coordinator about the state of play. And I think within Parliament we're happy with how things are, in terms of the organisation and structure end of it. We're probably a bit concerned about the pace of the negotiations, or maybe a perceived lack of progress on some issues. I have to say that these are very tense negotiations, so it's to be expected that things will be difficult in the beginning. But I think we're also aware that the clock ticks towards March 2019, and we are going to have to step up both sides to make sure that we achieve the desired outcome on Brexit Day, if you like, in 2019. So members of the House here are watching. Not everybody is as engaged with it as perhaps I would be or other colleagues, but our political groups are very engaged. And I would say that Brexit has been an issue around which member states have united and around which members of the European Parliament have united. And in particular, on the issue where we started our conversation around the peace process in Northern Ireland, there's huge interest and a huge desire to make sure that we do everything in our power to make all of the commitments in the peace process fully delivered on, and that Brexit doesn't interfere or damage it in any way. So, you know, from a citizen's point of view, the Parliament is important in the Brexit process. Michel Barnier is the lead negotiator. And to give him the credit where it is absolutely due, he has been incredibly good at talking to us in Parliament, at coming to member states, in speaking in their parliaments. And I think out of all of this, he's one of the key Europeans who is handling the most difficult of files, but doing it in a manner which could only be described as excellent.
Lastly, just before I let you go, I saw you mentioned in an interview that there are deep divisions at the EU level. Can I just ask what you meant by that? Did you mean that specifically in relation to Brexit or more generally?
I think in politics, and in a room full of 10 people, there are deep divisions. So I think it's almost stating the obvious that where any groups are gathered, there will be deep divisions. I think when you look at the future of Europe, there are differences between the political groups in our house here in the European Parliament as to the direction of Europe. And sometimes within political groups, there are differences between members from different countries. But on the broader level, I think since Brexit, we do have a very common unity of the 27, which is restating their commitment to Europe. And that was done in March in Rome, at the 60th anniversary of the signing of the Treaty of Rome. But that doesn't, if you like, make all of the differences that are clearly there go away. But what it does say is that we're prepared to talk about our different policies, our different perspectives, and to come up with a solution and a compromise that we can all, at the end of the day, sign up to. And that, in essence, is what Europe has always done from its very beginnings to where it is at today, where we work together and we use words and we amend and we negotiate and we sometimes leave the room and we come back into a room, but we reach an agreement where there is consensus and where compromise has been shown to be given on all sides. So for me, the reality of deep divisions is, as it is in my own member state, there are deep divisions politically, economically, between individuals and between political parties. The challenge for Europe is to not hide the difference, but to make sure that we accommodate all of the views, but that we have a common goal, which is to keep the unity of the European Union of 27, which will exist post-Brexit.
Now that is a great note to end on. Thank you so much for joining us.
My pleasure, and thank you for talking to me.
And that's all the Brexit news we have for you today. Do check back on Thursday and next week, as always, for any more Brexit news and opinions that you might need. I've been your host, Jennifer Han, here with my co-host, Tim Hemming, who's also my co-producer on the show, along with Warren Paul. Our theme song is brought to you by Kevin MacLeod, and we hope you'll be joining us again soon.